What's up, guys? Before we jump into the episode, I just want to give a really quick shout out. As you may have noticed, that intro music that we just played is a little bit different than the one that we usually play. And that is because our very close friend Dominic actually took the original sound that we had and then recorded it and made his own like acoustic cover of it, which is what you guys just heard. So we really appreciate Dom for doing that. Thank you so much. And without any further ado, let's jump into the episode. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of What I Wish I Learned. We are back in the studio for another episode on space.
Yes. So the reception from the first episode has been really good. I think people are really enjoying this space topic. Unlike our typical seasons where we go on for like 10 episodes per topic, this one's only going to be a three-part series. So we're going to try to condense this as much as we can. However, before we get into the episode, I want to introduce, we have a really cool guest with us today, and it happened by sheer luck. He came over to just work on my laptop because even though I'm good at talking about space and history in Vietnam, I'm pretty much the biggest idiot when it comes to noticing little things on my computer, so I couldn't figure out why my PC was running slow. So with us, we have my friend Ethan, and Ethan actually has a background in rocket science. So Ethan, if you want to introduce yourself in a little bit of your interest in all this.
Hey guys, I'm Ethan, local rocket scientist, and you know, by happenstance I was here and I was like, hey, I know a couple things about rockets. So just diving in to expand on the conversation a little bit.
Yeah, I think in this whole episode you might make me just look like an idiot through all of it. I can tell a good story.
Wouldn't dream of it.
I can tell a story, but you're gonna have to tell me all the science behind all of it.
All right. Well, we can make that happen.
Nice.
All right. Well, welcome Ethan. And I think we can keep our intro pretty short this time, so...
Cool. Noah, roll the music.
What if I just tell myself to roll the music? Roll the music.
All right. So, where we left off last episode, we were talking about it didn't really matter who would win the space race. Ultimately, Russia or the Soviet Union or the United States, they had the same people working on it in the background. We had Nazi scientists who ran all of NASA and all of Russia's rocket program as well. And so we also set up how science fiction as a whole really led the American culture to enable Nazis to begin our space program. And so today we're just going to keep that story going. And so I want to begin our story today with the detonation of a nuclear bomb from the Soviet Union in 1949. We don't really know what it's like to have experienced something like that in our lifetime. Because like we talked about in season one, we grew up in the Age of Terror. We've grown up pretty much on the edge of our seat constantly from what anywhere and anyone can just kill you. Right? There is the fear of terrorism around the world. And then there's also that added layer of, you know, national actors like this, like Russia today, which can just obliterate us within 30 minutes. And so in 1949, people had to experience that for the first time. And so when Russia detonated their first atomic bomb in 1949, which came way sooner than anyone thought, 4 years after we detonate ours. Actually, I think you probably know, Ethan, wasn't it an American scientist that defected and just gave Russia all their nuclear secrets and stuff?
That's a great question. I don't know. It would make sense, right? It's fairly complicated, and with so much of our work being so concentrated and being done in the dark, right? It's like no info about it got out until after it happened, mm-hmm. Right?
The Manhattan Project.
Yeah. Until after the Manhattan Project and after the end of World War II.
It's so crazy to me that they managed to keep that a secret for so long without people finding out about it. And that actually reminds me, do you remember when we were in history class with Mr. Clark and he made us watch all those old, like...
Duck and Cover?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That just reminded me of that. That was such a crazy, like, thing to see, like, just what they had to go through. Like, they would play those in school. Like, we're here worrying about, you know, this might be a little, it's a bit of a sensitive topic, but we're here having to worry about our schools getting shot up, and they're having to worry about their schools getting bombed.
Literally nuked, like, into oblivion, yeah.
Not much has changed, I guess. What's up, guys? It's Editor Noah here. Just want to interject really quick to give you guys a little bit more context on what we're talking about here with the duck and cover videos. So basically, these were PSA-style videos that were shown to children in schools during this time period of nuclear bomb threat that basically explained to them what they should do in the case of a nuclear bomb threat. So it featured this little cartoon turtle that would go around and sing this little childhood kind of song to make it more appealing to kids. And he would explain to them exactly how to respond and react in the case of a nuclear bomb. Hence why it was called Duck and Cover. He was telling them to duck and cover under their desks or under any kind of potential shelter that could be used. So just wanted to give you guys some context there. And I'm actually going to play a little clip of it right now, just so you guys can hear kind of what it was like. And then we'll hop back into the episode.
There was a turtle by the name of Bert. And Bert the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He's duck and cover. Duck and cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
And you.
And you.
And you. Duck and cover.
But what this invention of a nuclear bomb and the detonation of it does is, first, we've mastered atomic power, which on like the scale of like human evolution and like progression of society is one of the biggest steps you can make. I think that brings us up a tier as a class of a civilization. And Truman says we've harnessed the basic power of the universe as the greatest scientific gamble in human history paid off.
And I looked it up here real quick. And yeah, it was a German scientist who then supplied info from the American and British Manhattan Project to the Soviets. So
he did it because he said it's unfair for one country to wield all that power. He wanted there to be like a duality in the world between two opposing teams, basically.
That's very fair.
It makes sense, right? Because if America was the only one that had him, we would use him. Hence why we used it on Japan. But nuclear bombs end World War II, start the Cold War. And as World War II comes to an end, most people assume that fear will dissipate. War had just ended. Let's enter this age of peace and prosperity. However, the nuclear bomb changes the psyche forever because it creates the next generation of fear, right? The ultimate fear. However, with fear and the invention of nuclear bombs and harnessing the basic power of the universe, it also opens our minds to what's possible and looking beyond what we assumed was relatively reasonable. So maybe we can make atomic bombs. Maybe we can go to space. Maybe aliens exist. And most importantly, maybe because we can harness the power of the universe, we can go to the moon. And so as this entire podcast or the series is going on, is how can we capitalize on fear and the motivations of America into something good? And so after the war ends, fear begins, and life does not go back to normal. The entire planet is nearly on the verge of destruction. The Soviet Union and the United States enter their most brutal, you know, opposition into each other. And it's an escalation to the bottom. Companies do it all the time, you know, race to the bottom, who can get to the cheapest, you know, best product. But we were doing that with weapons. Who can make the biggest, most powerful bomb as quickly as possible? What was it? Fun fact alert. The Russians detonate the largest bomb ever created, the Tsar bomb, which is 50 megatons. Which would make the bombs that look like the ones we dropped on Japan, just a kiloton, which were in kiloton ranges, look like little firecrackers. A single Tsar bomb can blow up, if detonated here in Denver, would reach all the way to Colorado Springs and Fort Collins.
Wow. That's crazy.
Talk about fear, right? And so the world is marching forward into its own death. And so what we did to Japan could come back and bite us now. Because World War II was so far from home from us, the nuclear bomb brought it to us. It breaks the sanctuary that the U.S. has had for generations, and there's no more oceans to protect us, because death can come from any point. It ruins the landscape of the American mind, and what happens when you have all that fear? What do you do, Noah, when you really, really have a lot of fear in your life?
I just cry. I don't know.
What do you think most people do?
React.
React.
Like, react badly and like irrationally.
Mm-hmm. So when people have like really high anxiety or really high fear, they tend to do two things. They tend to either distract themselves, kind of just get lost in something. Calling back to our drug series, they might just get involved in something that will mentally distract them, get too far into Stranger Things, which I've been doing a lot of recently. Not because I'm scared, but they tend to distract. Or we tend to try to understand. You try to rationalize the fear. So as the bomb is creating the ultimate fear, yes, a lot of people are distracting, but a lot of people try to understand. And so as we talked about in episode one, the building of science fiction in America is getting to a critical point as well. And what sci-fi does in America is capitalize on fear in two great ways. A, it distracts America, because now we can talk about aliens. We can talk about like cool space westerns, and it gives us a semblance of understanding.
Right. Even though it's fiction, it gives us like the feeling of like having that understanding.
Yep. And so like the excitement and the fear that comes with atomic blasts also gives a lot of like reason to expand science fiction. And so we try to understand. And so cool thing about science fiction and understanding it is we now have like one of my favorite tropes in all of like American culture is now we can talk about aliens. So weird connections I'm making. I know it's probably hard to follow. Atomic bomb detonation leads to Americans being scared, and because of fear, we now have to distract ourselves. And science fiction comes into the picture with aliens. Aliens become a stand-in for our fears. They become the next pop culture. And so I think this is going to be like a little side rant about in our episode. I think it'd be kind of cool to talk about all the little aliens or UFO tropes that have kind of gone around in our culture. No, you ever heard of Roswell?
Yeah, I've been there actually.
Really? Mm-hmm. What was it like?
It's really cool. They have this like museum that's like just dedicated to aliens. Mm-hmm. And like they have like pictures of crop circles and like all this crazy stuff that, you know, are about aliens. Yeah, it's a pretty cool place.
Do you believe in aliens, Ethan?
Oh, absolutely.
Why?
I mean, the math, right? So you think about...
Fermi paradox.
Yeah, and like to summarize it and not break all the way through it, it's like, well, to wrap your mind around how absolutely vast the universe is, right? It's like there's billions of stars in our galaxy, right? Might, you know, there could be 10 billion. I don't remember the exact numbers, even though I have a background in astrophysics. And then there's billions of galaxies, right? I mean, it is so absolutely vast, and the time scales are vast, right? James Webb Space Telescope, we're getting pictures this week.
Oh, I'm so excited.
It is going to be really exciting. So with the redshift there, I mean, it's looking billions of years into the past, right? And so the thought is like, what are the odds that like you have 100 billion times 100 billion and we're the one singular event?
Like we're the only one.
Yeah.
Like
now, I think that there's that also has to run though on a time scale where it's like, well, they could have existed before, they could exist after. We could be in a unique pocket where maybe we are the only ones. At the same time, there's also a lot of weird stuff. The Congress releasing all their UFO reports earlier this year.
I saw those videos, yeah.
Right? And all the other things going on. Well, Transformers makes a good enough point about like how did we get some of the technological advancements that we got? Because the government's always ahead of where, you know, we as the public are, right, by at least 20 years in what they're doing.
So you're telling me the government's not using Dell computers?
No.
They might
HP.
Be.
So they're way ahead of us, yeah, you were saying.
Yeah, and no, they're way ahead. And so I definitely think that there's 100% chance that there's aliens that have or will exist or currently exist on a different planet somewhere in the universe.
Intelligent right? life or just life?
Both. I think there's odds that it's things are fairly well populated, right? And then from there, it's whether or not we've been visited. And it's like, well, if you could figure out how to surpass our current understanding of the laws of physics, you could totally make it happen, right? Because under our current understanding, it's like, well, these things are really far away, and it's really hard to get there, right? It's going to take 100,000 years. It could take a million. It could take even more because a light year is a far distance, and you have to travel really fast.
And we can't even get close to being at a light speed, too.
Exactly. But I could certainly see that as our understanding of what's possible changes and physics changes and harnessing energy. Yeah. No, you know, you think about a civilization that manages to survive a million years into the future and they can probably do whatever they want. Right. It's just that we on our own timescales haven't seen anything last that long because we as the human race have never been able to surpass our like small and earthly, cataclysms.
The bounds of our own. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So there could have been ancient things that were very technologically advanced, even like, you know, 12,000 years ago. Look at, you know, Göbekli Tepe and stuff. But I don't know. I think we need to get off of Earth so that we have a little bit more survivability from our small little catastrophes that happen here. And then I think that's where we have a chance of meeting aliens.
So you have this background in astrophysics, right? And rocket science. You know, I'm not even going to try to guess the exact term. It's probably way longer. But using not just the data to assume that there is something out there, how likely do you think that we are in like active contact or active, like, you know, aware that something else out there exists?
Well, you know what's crazy? Actually, I watched this documentary on Netflix. It's Unsolved Mysteries, and they have this episode that's about this whole entire town. I can't remember like where it is, but it's this whole town in the U.S. that claimed that they were visited by aliens. And multiple different people, like probably 20 different people in this town, on one specific day, all reported the exact same thing happening, and they were in completely different places, had zero contact with each other. Most of them didn't even know that other people existed until they started filming the documentary, and they all claimed to see this exact same thing. And they, and a few of them have claimed to be abducted. That's, you know, up in the air, but all of them claimed to see these lights that were just like floating around very, very close to the ground, like orbs of light that were just floating around.
Ball lightning.
Probably not, though, because they were happening in like multiple different areas of the place, and a few different people report abductions and all this stuff. And it's just super crazy to me. Like, obviously, there are people that claim that they've been abducted by aliens, but this one is so unique because it's so many different people all in one, you know, condensed area that had no contact or interaction with each other that all report the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just so crazy to me. Like, how does that happen?
Yeah. And I mean, that goes to probably the point I was going to make too, with 100%, right? Like 5 years ago, it might, maybe it would have been a coin flip, right? But knowing what we know now, with experiences like that, with, if you're in the Navy or you're in the Air Force, most of them were Navy, but if you're in a position like that and you're like saying it's a UFO, these are serious people doing serious jobs, right? This isn't like some dude on a farm who just wants attention. Right. Like, you're already flying jets for, you know, your profession. You get enough attention as it is. So for you to also see these things, it's like there's and their experiences seem to be unanimous, whether it's mm-hmm. people in a town, whether it's like it's always the same shape. They do the same things. Mm-hmm. They act in ways where we don't have the technology. We aren't even close. Like going from zero to Mach 10 in like the snap of a finger. We aren't even close to being able to do that.
Okay, but why were alien sightings not a thing before, you know, this topic that we're talking about now, before the 40s? Why are,
they probably were. They just didn't know how to conceptualize it.
Do you think religion comes in?
Say what?
Well, do you think that as public understanding of science and of the world around us broadens, as you include radio and then television, do you think that people deferring to random things they can't explain as religion slowly morphs yep. into science.
So that's yeah. actually what I have written in my notes here. Aliens really become the new plague or demons as they were in the olden times. So what you would explain yeah. is like a supernatural thing before, maybe because of science fiction and the narrative of culture in the U.S. now is like...
Yeah, it's like now we're looking through, like the now lens. We're looking at these experiences through the lens of science fiction, whereas back then, mm-hmm. maybe they were coming up with different ways, such as religion,
to try
and conceptualize yeah. these happenings yeah. that kept occurring.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Okay, all this like lens and the James Webb telescope and government experiments and all that, why do we still know so little or too little to nothing, right? Like our narrative and understanding of what aliens could be and the sightings of them also haven't changed in like 50 years.
I mean, we as the public.
Yeah.
Who is we?
But like, why not? Why don't we know more yet?
Well, you have to consider, you know, what are the ramifications of the government saying, oh, by the way, there's aliens. Right. And we're not the only people to think about that, right? The government, if they have aliens, you know, or knowledge of them, has to think, okay, what are the ramifications of telling the public this? We could destroy religion, which could be bad. We could cause panic. We could cause faith in institutions, to kind of crumble. Right. Because it's like, okay, well, the government said there's aliens, but we have no way to deal with whatever could happen there. And I mean, there's got to be a laundry list of think tank ideas to how
the reaction of the public would be.
Yeah. And so I think they're probably overreactions. I think everybody would be like, huh, wow. And the religious people would be like, well, that's hard to explain. And it, life would go on. But I don't know. I think the government keeps its secrets for its reasons. I do think it's a pretty big secret to keep, though.
I would say, like, you can't have that many generations of that many people knowing and nobody slipped up and has, like, come forward with a lot of concrete evidence.
Well, plenty of people have, right? But maybe it's that they've made it seem as though these are quack things, even if they say the truth.
Yeah, it's so easy to discredit somebody. Like, yeah. It's so much harder to prove that you're telling the truth than it is for, like, an institution to discredit just, like, one or two whistleblowers. You know,
it's true.
Yeah.
Actually, what was it? I'm going to go against what the only thing I just said. Neil Armstrong, right before his death, he was saying that when they were on the moon, he said that they had like a guest or someone that was like kind of just watching them, observing them from a little while. Literally right before he died, like a day, just released a statement. He was like, yeah, when we were on the moon, we weren't there alone.
What? Buzz Aldrin. Buzz Aldrin talks about like obelisks on Mars and stuff. He might be screwing with people, but there's a ton of stuff with Buzz Aldrin talking about like, oh yeah, no, I've seen like this and this and there's obelisks on Mars. And
yeah, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong being like that prime crew of like Apollo 11, I feel like we would trust them. But again, I just feel like at this point by 2022, we should know more.
Yeah. Like
you would think
if there were UFOs, like why haven't any of them crashed? Or like, you know, why don't we have any physical like evidence of it?
Yeah. Have you heard of the Great Filter? Either one of you?
Yeah.
No.
Do you want to explain part of it? Okay. So Great Filter, this kind of is a theory of why we don't have life or we have not contacted life in the galaxy yet. So it's assumed that all life goes through a filter at some point when developing, either very early on in its development, so some kind of catastrophe kills life off early and it doesn't have time to become what we are today. Mm-hmm. And so there's the thought of, are we the only civilization in our bubble of like contact that ever made it through that?
Yeah.
Or does every civilization get some point of development where they get to that later filter? Mm-hmm. Maybe they unlock the secrets of the atom bomb and it's too much for one people on one planet to handle and we all obliterate each other. So maybe we're getting to that point where we're the only civilization getting to that second filter, or we're the only ones that got through that first one. It's another explanation of why we don't know anybody.
Well, and that's where I was sort of alluding to, like, to make it to the point where we technologically are advanced enough to be like these aliens, right? We have to pass those gates. And a lot of the filters in that, in the theory, are based on sort of earthly catastrophes, right? Big volcano, meteor hits, ecological disaster, right? And it's like, I think technology creates some of them with nuclear power. I think just being a singular civilization on one planet
is
really
a terrible
hurts.
Idea.
Yeah. So as soon as we start colonizing other planets, it's sort of a gate we've passed because you could nuke the hell out of Earth
and survive on Mars or on the moon
or
on Titan or Ganymede or whatever.
Exactly.
And I kind of want to tie this back in and ask you guys both the question. So the heart of the Cold War and the invention of nuclear bombs and fear and aliens and all that, do you think it was more sensationalized now to talk about UFOs because we're trying to rationalize our fear of like total destruction? Or is it because like we genuinely have more capacity to notice these kind of things? It's a loaded question, I know.
I don't understand the question.
So like the increase of seeing aliens and UFOs, is that more of like a cultural sensation or is it like genuine sightings? And I know there's absolutely no way you can actually answer that, but what do you think?
Both.
Yeah. I would say both, but like the thing is, like now obviously we all have, you know, high tech HD cameras in our pockets all the time. Why don't we have like solid concrete HD video of these things? Like anybody
like
can just anybody can just whip out their phone and just start recording at any time.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we have better, like every recording you see of a UFO is always just like some fuzzy like weird thing,
blur,
yeah, that just like doesn't make any sense. Why don't we have like good like iPhone video
yeah.
well, of these things?
It could be speed. right? That's one
thing. Mach 10.
What we know from the Air Force is they move really fast, right? And so your camera has a shutter speed. It's the speed at which it physically is capturing the light. And Mach 10 is, so your Mach number is dependent on altitude because it depends on a ton of things about the air.
Nerd.
But assume an average that Mach 10 is like a little over 6,000 miles an hour.
Jesus.
And it's like, okay, so if we saw one of these things moving outside, it's going to take like a second to cross the view of this window. And if that, and the closer it gets, the faster. And then you're not, you know, your shutter speed may not pick it up. As for them like hovering around and floating, maybe they have invisibility technology that we don't know about. There's been plenty of people who've talked about that, where it came out of nowhere and then it was moving fast and then it disappeared and they have no clue.
So how much of this is the government's doing?
I again would say like 50-50.
Because like Roswell, the most famous, you know, landing or crash of an alien spacecraft, was later in an FBI report, which is to this day the most accessed FBI report in like in American history, of the Roswell like FBI report, and it comes down to being a weather balloon. So like I would imagine, like you said, like a couple minutes ago, the government has way more technology than us. So maybe they are testing things that we're just not quite understanding. Maybe we should just open our minds more to the fact that our government probably has that kind of tech, and if it were aliens, they probably would have bypassed government and talked to us.
Yeah.
Mm.
Although, no, it does make a good point. It's like, do these things only move fast, and are they only cloaked? Right.
Yeah.
Because if that's the case, then yeah, I think like, of course we aren't going to have videos, but I don't think that's the case. What about all the weird videos of like random lights floating in the sky at night, like over LA and over other places where there are a ton of videos, but it's just lights and it's unidentified.
Ethan, you're a rocket scientist. Have you seen a rocket launch into like a satellite launch or any kind of stuff before?
I've launched rockets.
Yeah. It looks weird in the sky. And yeah. if I saw a SpaceX launch in Florida. And I saw it like minutes afterwards over the horizon. I literally, and I for that brief moment accepted the fact that I just saw an alien because of the way it looked over the horizon. And that's me understanding space and rockets. I feel like most people, 50s, 60s, 70s, and even now don't really rationalize it. So maybe that's the lights they see.
Yeah. Well, and that it's sort of this unknown. What about people who live in LA or New York who come out? Oh, what was it? One of the cities, I think it was LA, they had a mass power outage for the first time in a while. And everybody saw for the first time the Milky Way. And people were calling 911 being like, what is going on? Is this the end of the world? Because they hadn't even seen stars before. Mm-hmm. And they just like had no concept living in their city that...
Yeah, that's what I was going to say is like most... of these alien sightings, quote unquote, are in rural areas which don't have as much light pollution from the city, which means obviously they can see more stuff in the sky than, you know, somebody living in LA or New York would see because of just the light pollution.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to kind of scale it back, you think it's even if it were government and the government tried to, or if it wasn't the government, they'd cover it up, would you believe them?
Depends what it is and what the evidence is.
Point right? I'm trying to make is I think that more people don't think it's the government because they just simply don't trust the government.
Yeah.
Because the government by nature hides everything. Like the fact that you just said they hid the Manhattan Project for like 5-6 years, nuclear bombs, we didn't even know. They hid all this kind of stuff. They hide every kind of secret. And to tie this into the rest of our series, they will hide even Nazis in our country. And so you and I were talking, Ethan, right before this about Wernher von Braun and how you actually knew him before even listening to our episode. And so this is a complete shift in narrative for our episode here. We're going to go back to the Nazis real quick and how they developed our entire space program. And so when we talked last, von Braun had just immigrated or as a refugee basically came to the U.S. and is now hiding out in our country. The official plan is we're going to keep him in America for about 6 months, have him share all the secrets about rocket science and send him back to Europe. Problem is half of Europe is under the control of our enemy. So we decided to keep von Braun after 6 months. And after a year, when we determine that he's no longer a problem, he becomes an asset. And he's granted citizenship within a year. And if within a year after that, within 2 years total, he becomes the director of the U.S. Ballistic Military Program. And so, kind of to tie this in, government will even lie about making a literal SS chief Nazi as our ballistic missile program. So in my mind, I think they'll even hide stuff like weather balloons or lights in the sky for us.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about all the Nazi travel post-war is that everybody talks about the American program having them, the Soviets having them. Additionally, Egypt took a bunch because they were very anti-Semitic at the time, and they were looking to make their own missile program to drop onto Israel. There were a ton of countries with their own sort of baby Nazi programs working through, trying to figure out how to put it, but basically working on their own rocket programs for their own reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really like how you said, or they brought it to the point of anti-Semitism, because even though, yes, our entire our program is created by Nazis, there's another, well, little less known anti-Semite by the name of Walt Disney. And this is going to be a crazy transition. I posted this on our Instagram, that our space program created by the Nazis, Von Braun himself, starts to push and lobby the President of the United States, Eisenhower, to create a missile program. Or a space program. And what's crazy is he takes the route of sci-fi and he writes a novel called The Mars Project.
Which would make sense why he, because he was inspired by all of the science fiction writings of that one guy. I forgot his name.
I did too. Campbell.
Yeah.
Campbell. We'll get to him too. So he writes this really crappy novel. And it
was bad?
Nobody liked it. He didn't even publish it. It was just passed around through their friends. However, one guy gets his hands on Von Braun's novel. Walt Disney. Walt Disney and a Nazi are now in talks about how to lobby the U.S. government to create a space program called NASA. And when Disney was building his brand new park, he had literally called Von Braun to visit Florida in where Disney World would now be and help him design Tomorrowland and create the most popular ride at the time, which was called A Ride to the Moon. And then Von Braun and Disney went into talks about getting Von Braun on TV and actually featured him weekly about promoting Disneyland. And their goal was to actually get the president to view that viewing and see how popular space has become to get Eisenhower to actually begin a NASA program.
That's crazy. That's actually crazy.
So Disney's literally viewing the Nazis in a positive view. Him and Von Braun would hang out nearly all the time after writing his stupid book.
But that's a little known fact about Disney, was that he was just very anti-Semitic.
I didn't know that until actually researching this. I straight up didn't see all the signs. And then when you look back on like the old shows.
If you look back at any of like Disney's super old cartoons, they were like super racist about literally every other race.
That's crazy.
Oh, Splash Mountain, the ride in Disneyland and World, is still, it's still like... it's a little iffy.
I bet Von Braun had some thoughts on that.
Oh, yeah.
When they were designing it. But thanks to this and thanks to his league with Disney, Von Braun and the army in link with Disney actually give space a positive view. And so now the goal is to get policymakers to actually change the law. And so to tie back to episode one, science fiction has now infiltrated American culture so deeply that it's blurred the lines between fiction and reality. People like Ethan from a young age can actually get inspired from science fiction like shows or even games and build a career out of this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And it gives us a glimpse into what our future can look like. And so you still are like really working into getting to NASA right now. And so like rocket ship science and the cool, it just honestly, I'm gonna use my bad word here, genuinely badass to kind of want to do that kind of stuff. And that wasn't part of American culture previously.
Yeah.
And it's kind of weird to think that two anti-Semites, Von Braun, a Nazi SS officer, and Disney were part of the core of building that kind of culture in our country. Absolutely radical to think about that. And then Von Braun and his other... you said a second ago, he was reading a novel when he was in Nazi Germany called... I can't even remember. I even did the episode. But he was reading that novel every week about space. The guy that actually got him into space stuff was Campbell and the novel he was writing through the New York Times. And so Von Braun actually reaches out to him and they get in link. And so Von Braun starts to talk to him and Campbell convinces Von Braun that organized religion is a detriment on all space travel. And that to get Americans to rationalize space, they needed to abandon religion more. They needed to create their own science and link with their own psychology.
Yeah, because religion just rationalizes everything and like under the scope of, whatever the religion is, yeah. Whereas science fiction is quote unquote more based in reality, yeah. Even though technically it's really not.
Yeah.
But it makes people think that way.
Mm-hmm. And so it's like a race between science and fear, right? Both science and religion try to rationalize that sort of fear and misunderstanding. But Campbell tries to blend science and fear together. And so he gets in link with another guy by the name of L. Ron Hubbard.
Why does that sound familiar?
Huh? I said his name wrong. Say it correctly.
Hubbard.
That name sounds familiar.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I've heard of that guy.
He creates Scientology.
Oh.
So now Von Braun, Campbell, and Disney are sitting in a room together. And they're talking about how to rationalize and to lobby government into space and the public. And L. Ron
Hubbard
takes a different approach of, well, let's take one of the most fundamental institutions in the world of organized religion and do it our own style. And so he creates Scientology, which today is one of the most
hated, hilarious,
insane kind of groups. Yeah. I mean, we didn't know that then, or maybe he did, but still to this day, I know very little about Scientology except from the lens of this episode of they want to understand science and rationalize it into the thought of how it connects with your brain and telepathy and you as I don't even know, stardust or some crap.
It's pseudoscience. It's literal pseudoscience, but they call it Scientology because, they want to make it sound more legitimate.
It's pseudoscience wrapped in religious theming. So it's 9,000-year-old aliens whose spirits are trapped on Earth, and then through your devotion to Scientology, you can become a vessel for their soul to then enter you so they can leave the Earth.
Is that true? Is that
That's basically
no way, dude.
That's bonkers. That's the spark notes.
Isn't that called Dianetics or something? That whole practice of whatever they're doing.
Sounds like crazy religion to me.
Yeah, but. Right?
Yeah.
Well,
and then I know that they extort their members for
buku bucks.
Insane amounts of money,
mm-hmm.
which obviously they need it to stay afloat because no one else takes them seriously. Religion?
Right. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure their religion doesn't actually have a soul or a spirit. It's all wrapped in the human mind. And so, they tried to take your fear and save you through science from your fear. Mm-hmm. I think that's, I try to sum it up that way. But every single one of the early creators all start at the same root, through Campbell and through early science fiction writing, through that first novel in the Wall Street Journal. So, Tomorrowland and Disney World, the U.S. Ballistic Missile Program, NASA, and Scientology all started from one science fiction comic book in the New York Times in 1931. So, talk about pop culture and how that can really, really shape everything.
Oh, yeah.
But we're looking at it from the scope of our world. And by world, I mean the West in America. So, while we're trying to rationalize Scientology and Dianetics and transcending alien beings through stardust and reading comic books, the Russians are doing their own thing. And while we're literally creating Disney World, the Russians release Sputnik. Sputnik means satellite in Russian, or companion, right? And so that's where most people see the space race actually beginning, is the launch of Sputnik on October 4th, 1957. And believe it or not, America actually wasn't even scared about it. Eisenhower even called the Soviet premier and congratulated him. Good job. Most people didn't really, they were way more scared of the aliens that are in their sky than the actual Russian satellite overhead. And it actually took lobbying from Von Braun to tell him, yo, this is a Sputnik moment, which is still used today in talking. Obama actually said it all the time in his campaign trail, a Sputnik moment, a turning point in society. Von Braun lobbies him, tells him, well, space and the moon are not just a fun dream that we can talk about in comic books and create crazy religions. It's actually a strategic military target. You can put missiles in space and on the moon, and now whoever can control the moon can control Earth. And so we're actually getting to that point of why we actually went to the moon now. Sputnik organized that by saying it's more of a strategic point than just a fever dream. And so now pop culture and companies lay out four reasons why it's now important to go to space because of Sputnik. There's the civil component, right? We have it in our hearts yes, we did it. There's the military component. We can get bombs in space. The political component, a giant middle finger to Russia. And the science component. think about all the research we can now do in space. And so pretty much what ultimately gets what Sputnik does for the U.S. culture is the government publishes a report saying Russians release a satellite in space, productivity in America drops, so we actually need to beat them to space because we need to get increased productivity because people are going to be more motivated.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Hold on. I just want to take a minute right now just to address how crazy this whole space thing has been. Because, like, we started out this season of, like, talking about Sputnik and, you know, you saying that, like, oh, okay, we're going to frame this storyline further back in history than Sputnik, even though that's when most people, that's what most people associate with the beginning of the space race. Yeah. And so I just think it's crazy that we, you know, tied all of this back to the first episode of like, you know, we're going to go back in time further than Sputnik, which is where people tend to
begin their story.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And now we're back. Now we're back at Sputnik again.
That's kind of how I wanted to wrap up this episode. We'll still have a lot of discussion here. But most of what we know about space and specifically the space race starts with Sputnik. And so like that's why I just spent so very little time on it. But like, think about it. We've now talked for 90 minutes straight about all the background that led to Sputnik and how all of us in our bubble in America were actually changing culture narrative around science fiction, Nazis,
and all of this stuff was going on at like before anyone even realized it, like before it even like clicked in the like the minds of the population.
Yeah, and it only caught the attention of the population when Kennedy went out and said literally to the public, by the end of the decade, we will go to the moon. People don't realize it took decades of lobbying and decades of like just natural shift in people's minds that got to that point. And so I said it in episode one, I'm pretty sure, it was not Kennedy's idea nor desire to go to space. He was essentially, his hand was forced when he was elected to office. Eisenhower ignored space. He ignored von Braun. He ignored Disney and he ignored the population. He even ignored Sputnik because in his mind, strategically, it was a waste of money. And it was.
Yeah, it really was.
Like the Soviets literally bankrupted themselves with their space program. We were lucky that America's like the only hyper wealthy country to ever exist in history. Right. And so we could just tank that kind of cut. Right, that money. But yeah, the Soviets literally bankrupted themselves. And so Eisenhower strategically as an allied commander did not see it as a viable option. But Kennedy being more of like a, you know,
a visionary.
Yeah, and a politician than a general was like, yeah, let's do it. It's going to help American psyche.
Yeah.
And it did. Like, that's the only thing that it really did was, you know, promote America even more.
Well, I mean, you would argue with that probably, all the scientific advancements that came with it. GPS.
Yeah, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, right? In that we were in the position where Russia was not. We had 80% of the world's money and the strongest economy coming out of World War II, right? Because of how things were played. And I'm sure they're like trade nations in the past who are quote-unquote hyper wealthy. The thing is that the extent of having a massive pile of gold in like 400 AD does not go as far, right? But as for the spending, it's like, is it a waste?
I don't think so. I think we should spend our entire military budget on space, but
yeah.
Let's throw $1.5 trillion at NASA.
You imagine what we would do.
I think by the end of the decade, we'd colonize our solar system.
And a lot of that is, well, I think of it in a few ways, like the lens of the economy, right? And it's like, we have to spend money somewhere, right? And so the more you throw into engineering and R&D, right, infrastructure would be preferred, but like engineering and all that go back, that government spending goes back into GDP, right? Not all government spending does.
For every dollar you spend on infrastructure and education, it returns $3 within 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And it's similar with these engineering projects. Then you get to the actual advancements that have come out of it. GPS was probably everybody's first example.
Insulation. Right?
What?
Insulation, home insulation that came from the space program.
Cool. I didn't know that. Yeah. There's a ton. Well, the engineering process in general, right? So you look at the rockets that took us like to the moon, right? The
Saturn V.
Very cool. If you ever get to go down to the Space Center in Florida and stand under it.
33 stories tall, dude.
Oh my God.
It's so cool.
It's unimaginable the scale of the thing. But we can't build another one.
It's still the most complicated machine we've ever built.
Yeah. We couldn't build another one today because it was on such a tight time frame and there were so many issues that we had to sort out that there were tens of thousands of like little baby fixes, little band-aids that were put on it as we were building the rocket, that like some engineer ran into an issue, you know, changed a bolt to a different thing, didn't document it because there wasn't time. Mm-hmm. And like, we cannot physically reproduce that rocket today.
What was it?
And they are some of the best rockets we've ever had. But that has now put in place a variety of things with our engineering process. Another one is factor of safety. Factor of safety is a thing. It's used a lot in aerospace, and it's been honed a lot in that you look at, like, how much force is it going to take to break the wing off this plane? Right. Mm-hmm. And then you go, okay, we need to design it so it can take 1.3 times that maximum force, right? Or how much really would it sustain, right? How much force is this wing going to take? Let's go like 30% over that, and let's make it that strong. That's a huge one that now, like, everything in your daily life that is thoroughly engineered, you know, maybe not a mic stand, but like a car, a plane,
a Dell computer.
A Dell computer. Yeah, there's like factors of safety in there, in the battery, of like, okay, it's likely only going to get this hot. Mm-hmm. Let's make it so that the battery survives 30% over that. There is so much technological advance that kind of hit the gas pedal on.
Can I ask you a question that's going to kind of derail you a little bit, Ethan? Please. Is it bother you that the career path you have chosen, the entire form, like, foundation of it was built on Nazis, and the entire culture around it was built around it, like, Disney? No, and that
I think it's a bad point of view to have in general. I think, like, oh well, then America was built on slaves. It's like, okay, fine, but we're here, you know. Mm-hmm. A couple hundred years later. Or how about, like, world, the economies in general are built on serfdom. Mm-hmm. Right? Or like, religion is based on people getting crucified and this and that. Well, Christianity specifically.
Yeah. I mean, all of human history is plagued with like some just really messed up stuff.
Yeah.
But like, that stuff had to happen in order for us to be where we are today as a species.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the TLDR of it is, I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care. Rockets are cool.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. Do you think we could be at where we're at today without like Wernher von Braun?
I think we would probably have gotten there eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not as quickly, or maybe not as like with as focused and direct of a goal as von Braun had. But I think we would have gotten there eventually.
Well, and so much of it is based on experience and learning, right? In that, like, building a rocket's a really iterative process, right? In the rocket lab I was in, it was, I mean, a lot of testing and a lot of blowing stuff up. Mm-hmm. To learn to get to the next stage.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the Nazi scientists, von Braun and everybody, brought with them that understanding and that knowledge that today, with how our information works, it's a lot easier and more condensed, and it's not maybe generational. But back then, it's like, that guy had a ton of info in his head that nobody else would have had.
That's true. There's no database to access, right? Online.
And so if he didn't write it down, then it was dying with him. And so the rockets he made and the advances he made that were then documented, that was how that info was passed on. So there was none of that info existed outside of him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some other scientists, yeah, yeah, he worked with. So no, if he hadn't been a part of it, it would have been an immense setback, because we would have had to start in at least early 1940s, like German rocketry. Right. If not earlier in von Braun's career, because I forget what he did pre-war. Right. So, like, we have to do all of that catch up on somebody who is probably a genius. And mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it would have been a massive setback.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's kind of crazy how you, like, you have to set aside ethics in that time period to get somewhere more important, right? To get somewhere better. Like, we had to set aside the fact that this guy created V2 missiles that would bomb London and likely gave, you know, the Nazi war machine just even more ammunition to continue and sustain its, like, terror ring. But it led to, and we'll talk about it next episode, moon landing.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's just like, wow.
I mean, and that's where the question comes from, is like, you know, maybe how do these lives balance out, right? How do the lives lost from, like, you know, missile programs balance with maybe the
lives saved with, like, MRIs?
Oh yeah, and other technology. I don't know. Is it worth it? It's a question for you guys.
It's a question for the audience.
Question for you guys to think about at home. And on that note, I think we're going to go ahead and cut the episode there. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thanks to Ethan for being an awesome guest. And we'll see you guys in the next one.